Welcome to The Man from 2063, where the past meets the future with Jack Duffy, here on Blog Talk Radio. Whether it's conspiracy theories, politics, current events, sports, entertainment, or historical events, Jack will keep you fascinated with entertaining guests on every show. This show is no hold bars. Now your host, Jack Duffy.
Good evening, everyone. This is Jack Duffy, the host of the Man from 2063 show. We have another exciting program tonight. I've just been very, very honored to have so many great guests the last several months, and tonight is another great guest. I'm honored to have Mike Bushman as my guest tonight. Mike graduated from the University of Illinois with a B.S. in journalism. He then went on to get an MBA with honors from the University of Chicago. He spent 25 years working in the interwoven worlds of national and global government, business, and media. He retired in 2012 as the top policy and communications executive for a global sustainability services company to pursue a career as an author. His first two novels, which we're going to talk about tonight, The Melting Point 2040 and Secession 2041, tell action suspense stories of a future America segregating toward division. He is currently writing a third book in the series describing a pathway toward reuniting America around a common but politically neglected moral principle. How are you doing, Mike? It's great to have you on tonight.
Thank you very much, Jack. It's great to be with you, and I appreciate the opportunity to join you.
Well, tell the audience where they can get your books.
Oh, sure. Yeah, the Melting Point 2040 and Secession 2041 are available at any of the online retailers, Amazon, BarnesandNoble.com, and any of the others, Smashwords.com. And they're available in both paperback form and in Kindle version. And, of course, the Kindle version is a lot cheaper, but they're in paperback and Kindle. And on Barnes & Noble, it's available in Nook and some of the other different formats.
Well, I always ask my guests when they've written books, what made you write these books, or what was it that caused you to write these books?
You know, I worked in Congress a little over 20 years ago as a staffer for a Southern Illinois Democrat who was kind of a moderate Democrat back when that was allowed to exist. And the guy I worked for worked across party lines all the time. His view is that government was there to solve problems for the people. And what I've seen happen in government over the last, especially 15 years, is we have become so divided and so partisan in our politics at a national level, and that's taken its way down to state and other levels as well. And we really need to get back to where government focuses on solving problems. And the single biggest problem that really worries me is that as a nation we've been moving since Brown versus Board of Education back in 1954, we were integrating as a country. We're increasingly getting closer together. About 15 to 20 years ago, we started reversing that trend. And Americans are now very segregated in where we live and how we behave and even in what news we listen to, so that we don't even share a common fact base. That division is ultimately going to cause really serious problems for the nation. And in fact, it even threatens our survival. And so I wrote stories of what the future will look like, you know, just as you've done with your book, where you use history to talk about what the future might look like. I think stories of what that future can look like using the history.
Welcome to The Man from 2063, where the past meets the future with Jack Duffy, here on Blog Talk Radio. Whether it's conspiracy theories, politics, current events, sports, entertainment, or historical events, Jack will keep you fascinated with entertaining guests on every show. This show is no hold bars. Now your host, Jack Duffy.
Good evening, everyone. This is Jack Duffy, the host of the Man from 2063 show. We have another exciting program tonight. I've just been...
Welcome to The Man from 2063, where the past meets the future with Jack Duffy, here on Blog Talk Radio. Whether it's conspiracy theories, politics, current events, sports, entertainment, or historical events, Jack will keep you fascinated with entertaining guests on every show. This show is no hold bars. Now your host, Jack Duffy.
Good evening, everyone. This is Jack Duffy, the host of the Man from 2063 show. We have another exciting program tonight. I've just been very, very honored to have so many great guests the last several months, and tonight is another great guest. I'm honored to have Mike Bushman as my guest tonight. Mike graduated from the University of Illinois with a BS in journalism. He then went on to get an MBA with honors from the University of Chicago. He spent 25 years working in the interwoven worlds of national and global government, business, and media. He retired in 2012 as the top policy and communications executive for a global sustainability services company to pursue a career as an author. His first two novels, which we're going to talk about tonight, The Melting Point 2040 and Secession 2041, tell action suspense stories of a future America segregating toward division. He is currently writing a third book in the series describing a pathway toward reuniting America around a common but politically neglected moral principle. How are you doing, Mike? It's great to have you on tonight.
Thank you very much, Jack. It's great to be with you, and I appreciate the opportunity to join you.
Well, tell the audience where they can get your books.
Oh, sure. Yeah, the Melting Point 2040 and Secession 2041 are available at any of the online retailers, Amazon, BarnesandNoble.com, and any of the others, Smashwords.com. And they're available in both paperback form and in Kindle version. And, of course, the Kindle version is a lot cheaper, but they're in paperback and Kindle. And on Barnes & Noble, it's available in Nook and some of the other different formats.
Well, I always ask my guests when they've written books, what made you write these books, or what was it that caused you to write these books?
You know, I worked in Congress a little over 20 years ago as a staffer for a Southern Illinois Democrat who was kind of a moderate Democrat back when that was allowed to exist. And the guy I worked for worked across party lines all the time. His view is that government was there to solve problems for the people. And what I've seen happen in government over the last, especially 15 years, is we have become so divided and so partisan in our politics at a national level, and that's taken its way down to state and other levels as well. And we really need to get back to where government focuses on solving problems. And the single biggest problem that really worries me is that as a nation we've been moving since Brown versus Board of Education back in 1954, we were integrating as a country. We're increasingly getting closer together. About 15 to 20 years ago, we started reversing that trend. And Americans are now very segregated in where we live and how we behave and even in what news we listen to, so that we don't even share a common fact base. That division is ultimately going to cause really serious problems for the nation. And in fact, it even threatens our survival. And so I wrote stories of what the future will look like, you know, just as you've done with your book, where you use history to talk about what the future might look like. I think stories of what that future can look like using the history of where we've been and what's happened in other countries who've gone through these circumstances really helps us to get an understanding that we're headed down a dangerous path right now.
Right. Well, I want to tell the audience that I highly recommend both of these books. I think they're fantastic. They were well written and very entertaining, and I really highly recommend them and hope you'll buy them. Let's talk about the first one, Melting Point 2040. A teenage immigrant from Mexico living in Arizona is the main character in your book, driven by what he sees as anti-Spanish discrimination to become a political activist. This fellow, Juan, strikes readers as a sympathetic, intelligent figure showing unusual sophistication for an 18-year-old. Why did you center your story around him?
Well, I think the whole immigration and segregation issue, and certainly we're seeing the immigration play out on a national stage and in fairly robust terms these days, there are legitimate reasons to have different perspectives. And one of the things I try to do in my books is to have characters who legitimately represent those different perspectives. If you look out 25 years from now, In the southwest states, in Texas, Arizona, New Mexico, and by then I believe Congress will have split California in half to give the Democrats four senators from a North California and a South California. You'll have heavy Latino majorities in those four states if the demographic trends play out as most people are predicting these days. The pressure when those turn into Latino majorities, you'll have politicians who decide that the best way to build favor with the community is to do everything they can to want to align with those Hispanic majorities, even if that alignment may not fit with the broader national interest. And certainly we've seen examples of that even in today's politics. But so, you know, Juan Gonzalez, who's the main character in the book, comes into the world as an 18-year-old, an immigrant from Mexico. He's raised in a school on the Arizona border that actually teaches him all day in Spanish. English isn't a part of his everyday life, and it's not surprising that living in that world, he thinks the world should accommodate his language preference. And so he runs into trouble with acquiring jobs in some national retailers, uses that to sue, and really that's kind of what I use as the trigger point of the language segregation battle between, you know, Spanish only in some parts of the country, English only in some parts of the country, and, you know, kind of a countervailing character who faces that same challenge where, you know, he's in a community where he was raised speaking English. He can't get a job because he's not Spanish-speaking in a part of the United States, something that actually already happens today.
Okay. Well, another important element of the story is a survivalist organization called New Right and a young adherent named Pete. You seem to suggest that survivalist groups will expand in the coming years. Do you think that that's where we're headed?
Yeah, I think we've seen a real growth in the movement toward people to be prepared and to be self-reliant. We've seen pressure from, you know, we've seen the government become increasingly belligerent towards the citizens to where public service is more of a control and less service than perhaps it was 15, 20, even 30 years ago. And when that happens, people tend to get, you know, a little concerned. When we segregate as a society, which we've certainly done, you know, if you look at, you know, how our schools are segregated, how our communities are segregated, we're not getting to know our neighbors who might come from a different background, might have a different national heritage as frequently in many parts of the country as we would have 20 or 30 years ago. And we get that divide. People tend to isolate themselves. They get fearful. And when people get fearful, they try to figure out how are they going to survive if we ever do get into a conflict. And so, you know, the New Right organization is, you know, becomes a national entity. It starts with survival gaming and kind of grows from there. And Pete is kind of one of those misguided kids who doesn't really know what he wants to be when he grows up and gets attracted into the survivalist community and finds himself in many ways becoming a pawn for other people's interests.
Okay. Well, since I live in Texas, I took particular note of your storyline showing the states of Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, and California del Sur trying to break apart from the rest of the country. What makes you think that that's going to happen? And many in Texas would like to see Texas separate alone. How does California del Sur come about in your view?
Yeah, you know, those are great questions. I think you know, you look at California del Sur, there's actually a ballot initiative in California that's been funded by a wealthy Silicon Valley entrepreneur to split California into six states. I don't see Congress ever approving that kind of separation. But as I look out over the next 25 years, you know, California is, you know, a very large part of the United States. It's the most populous of our states. And, you know, there will be a point where I think the Democratic Party will look at splitting the state as an opportunity to gain two more reliable Democratic votes in the Senate. That will actually be what I think is the driver there. In Texas, there's no doubt that there's pressure that Texas and Texans like to think of themselves as different. And, you know, there are a lot of differences between Texas and many other parts of the country. I just think that for a secession effort to really be able to succeed, it's going to need to be broader than any individual state. And there'll be a lot of drivers behind this that, you know, as I go through the story in the book, you start to see how it would make sense that these states would pull out together rather than one of them just going on its own.
That's interesting. I noticed that you cite secession research by a professor in the book. Is that real?
Yeah, you know, David Layden is a professor at Stanford University. He used to teach at the University of Chicago, which was one of my alma maters. And a lot of his research, and there were actually a number of other academics who've done a lot of research, looked at what drives secession efforts around the world. And how do nations get to the point where the divisions internally become so difficult that countries break apart? And what they found is that on the language issue, if a part of the country, you know, you get more than 10% of citizens in a nation who speak a primary language other than the main language, particularly if those citizens are geographically concentrated, there's inevitable pressure for that part of the country to break apart from the main nation. And it can be repressed for periods of time, as long as the central government's willing to actively repress those secession efforts. But inevitably, in looking through history over a much longer period than even they looked through, you see that over a period of a couple of hundred years, nations that don't have common elements of unity get pulled apart. And part of a big driver for why I wanted to write these two books was I don't want to get to that point where there's a few triggers that come along, and if we decide we're going to break apart, we're going to do it violently, and we run the risk of riots, conflicts, even civil war. So it's important to make sure that we're building unity as we go along, and we just haven't been doing that lately. So David Layden's research, one of the findings I found interesting was, you look at the last 50 years of the 20th century, there were 127 civil wars fought around the world. 17 million people died in those. And the three primary characteristics that nations were being divided along were language, race, or religion. And so I think we need to be particularly careful as a country that we not allow ourselves to segregate along those lines if we don't want to get to a point where there's inevitable pressure for the nation to divide.
Well, that's very interesting. The United Nations gets involved in the secession effort in your book, Melting Point 2040. Why would the U.S. allow the United Nations to intervene?
Yeah, you know, that's certainly a twist in the book that I think some people question. Why, you know, could we ever get to the point where the United Nations was allowed into the United States? And certainly I don't think if you looked at today, would we allow the U.N. troops inside our borders? The answer would be no, but the circumstances, as you saw in the book, that build, where Mexico gets worried that the U.S. might be looking at invading them. There are conditions created where people claim that there's going to be an anti-Latino genocide in the Southwest because the Southwest states have voted in favor of a secession referenda. You can set conditions that would give the UN reason to want to protect U.S. citizens. And there are a lot of countries, China, Russia, a lot of the Middle East countries, that have a strong desire to try and see the United States weakened. And in some cases, to pay the U.S. back for, you know, having intervened in some of their internal affairs. So, you know, the UN initially gets involved not as part of a big conscious effort, but a few mistakes along the way in how diplomacy is handled, and all of a sudden we've got troops from other nations inside our borders with the idea of protecting our citizens from ourselves. And, you know, and there are, of course, dangerous consequences that go with that.
Okay. Since the book is set in the future, one of the more interesting things about the story involves the technology that you expect to exist in 2040. Can you describe the impact of the nation where vehicle movement is controlled by national software, as well as your prediction for what appears to be an all-in-one computer ID payment device?
Yeah, you know, it's one of the pieces that I think is fun about using history to write about the future is it gives you a chance to think about where we're headed. And one of the things that I believe is coming for the U.S. is the idea of driverless cars. Now, when Melting Point 2040 first came out, they weren't out there. Google hadn't announced that that they were going to pilot test their driverless car. I also believe that the cars are going to be reshapable, and nobody had heard of that. Well, just in the last couple of years, we've started to see evidence that car companies are designing along those ways. And there's good reason to get to kind of an automated driverless car. You take away human error. People get distracted as drivers. They're not very fuel efficient. You get safety issues. If we're not allowed to control our cars, you don't run into some of the speeding and other traffic issues. The problem with that is it means that you've got a national software system that is controlling all vehicle movement. And then the person who controls that national software, as I wrote through in both Melting Point and in Secession, has an amazing ability to use that control of our vehicle traffic to for purposes other than what it might be intended. So I'm all for improving safety, fuel efficiency, and how our roads are maintained, but I do think we've got to be careful about letting government, you know, have that much control over our ability to move from place to place. That ability to be mobile is one of the critical elements of freedom in the United States that I think we need to make sure we continue to treasure.
Okay.
So on the LifeLink side, we look at our credit cards, at our computers. I think we're moving toward a place, and we're starting to see evidence of this already, where we're going to get to having, you know, a simple card that really serves as our all-encompassing identification payment card, folds out as a computer. Now, as we get that, it's going to become extremely valuable. So the security around that's going to have to be critical. There's going to be facial recognition features, fingerprint IDs, even DNA analysis capabilities built into these cards. And we're going to have to design clothes that have secure pockets that enable us to protect it from theft so that we don't suddenly lose who we are, you know, in this single card, and find our lives turned upside down. So those are two of the technologies that I write about in the book, because I think it's important to think about that the world's a little bit different 25 years from now than the one that that we live in today.
Okay. You talk about deep tunnels that are owned by drug cartels that help facilitate more than just drug distribution in the book. If you look at the illegal immigrant problem that is dominating today's news, it appears that illegal immigrants are just walking or floating across our border. Why do you think deep tunnel technology will be so important in 2040?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. It's interesting where we are on illegal immigration. I don't think where we are is where we're going to be over the next 20 years. I think most people are starting to recognize that there's a limit to how open the U.S. borders can be and maintain the sanctity of the nation. I mean, I'm all for immigration. I think legal immigration is a really important part of the success of the country. But when you have illegal immigration that takes over, they don't have that same connection to the country. They aren't invested in the success of our nation, which you want people who live here to be invested in our success. So we've got to make sure that we switch our immigration to illegal immigration. I don't think most of our presidents are going to allow the kind of unsecure borders while claiming to have secure borders that our current president is doing, or that, for that matter, President Bush allowed under his administration. So I think, you know, we'll have a reaction near term to what we're seeing today that will lead to more border security. And, of course, as we have that reaction, the cartels who are, you know, raise a lot of money through helping illegal immigrants get into the United States are going to try and find a way around that. And I think we're going to see increasingly sophisticated cartels. And, you know, the Department of Homeland Security just last December issued a report saying they don't have the ability to identify and monitor where the cartels are building tunnels. Now, they do find tunnels from time to time, but we'll see the depth of those tunnels and the speed at which they're able to build them and the ability to conceal those, I think, get greater and greater as time goes by.
You use a college professor to run classroom discussions on language mandates and secession issues in which students advocate multiple sides of each issue in pretty aggressive debate. In fact, it might not be clear to readers exactly where you come out on these issues from these debates. Why did you decide to use this device, and what do you hope happens for readers?
Yeah, you know, it's an important thing, in my view, to really understand all sides of an issue. You know, I had a college professor at University of Chicago who, one of the most important things I think I learned in my educational career was his advice that I spent 80% of my time seeking information that suggests I'm wrong and only 20% seeking evidence that I might be right. And I think it's important when writing about issues as complex as immigration issues or language mandates that we understand all sides of the issue and that we understand the different perspectives. So, you know, I use the University of Chicago classroom setting and debate inside that classroom over the issues as a way of bringing to life, along with the story, the policy, the reasons for real policy differences, and that people do have legitimate different perspectives. It's only when we really understand where people who have a different perspective come from that we can find solutions that we can all work with. Today, you know, when you look at public policy debates, especially when you're listening to the news media, all you hear is people screaming past each other. Nobody's actually really listening and trying to find common ground. So I hear so many issues, and I think immigration is one of those where what the Democrats are saying is the only way and what the Republicans are saying is the only way. Neither one of them is actually the right way, but if they listen to each other, you'd find the solutions in between. I don't want to tell the readers what that solution is, but I do want to make sure the issues are exposed in a way that helps readers crystallize in their mind that they've thought through what their beliefs are and what they believe is the right answer so that they can understand how important an issue it is and maybe get a little bit engaged in it, a little more so than maybe some are today.
Okay. You seem in your book to suggest that politicians are sometimes too focused on their own self-interest to put the country first and that the media have become so partisan that they are no longer neutral. Is this just your perspective, or do you think we are already in that situation now?
Yeah, I really do believe that we're in a particularly bad place today. So, you know, if I look at Fox News, and then I flip the channel and listen to MSNBC or CBS, I don't even have an idea that I'm in the same country because their perspectives on what's going are just so different. And they don't always do a good job of explaining the other side. And certainly you look at, if you read the New York Times, your idea of what's going on in the country is dramatically different than if you're reading, you know, the Daily Caller or Breitbart News or any of, you know, the more, or some of the conservative outlets. So I think it's important to have to look at diverse media sources to, you know, make sure you're getting different perspectives. But our politicians aren't doing a good job of, you know, trying to be nonpartisan. I mean, when I worked in Congress, we would have, you know, the first year of every two-year election cycle, I think people worked really well across party lines to try and solve problems. And then the second year of the election cycle tended to be much more politically oriented. Today, you know, they get inaugurated, and the next day, if even the next day, it's all partisan divide, and there's no real serious effort to find common ground. So I think we're in a bad place today. I don't think the media has helped it, but certainly I think our political leaders deserve most of the, I don't know, the word isn't credit, but most of the blame for how bad it's gotten lately.
There are several references in the book to the Political Freedom Constitutional Amendment to reform our political system. What role does political reform need to play in America's future, and what role does it play in your book?
Yeah, I think it's really important to recognize that our political system is at the core of all of our flaws. You know, the fact that we, our politicians, spend most of their time raising money, that our primaries are so divided, that our, you know, the redistricting process. So the Political Freedom Amendment is something I talk about in the book, is a constitutional amendment that I think we're going to need to impose on our political system to shorten the election cycle, the 60-day cycle, so we're not in perpetual campaign mode, to ban fundraising outside of those 60-day cycles, to get to where we hold open primaries and the top two candidates advance, to make redistricting something that's done, you know, by a random computer-generated map, so we're not creating all safe Republican and safe Democratic districts with, you know, 20 or 30 swing districts in between, so that there's real competition, there's a real likelihood that a politician isn't going to decide who their next set of constituents are, but they're actually going to have to represent a broader group of people than most of them do today. And I think that that political reform, it's almost a precondition to getting America back on the kind of track that we need to be on as a nation.
Well, I want to let our audience know that there's a call-in number if you want to ask Mr. Bushman a question or some questions about his books. They're very fascinating. The call-in number is area code 347-989-8459. That's 347-989-8459. So we welcome calls from the audience. In the second half of the show, I wanted to talk about your other book, Mike. It's just as interesting, Secession 2041. You talk about there are a lot of similarities between the plot lines in Secession 2041 and what has been happening in Ukraine after you released this book. What makes you believe that what is happening in Ukraine could happen in America's Southwest?
You know, that's a great question, and especially today with the downing of a Malaysian Airlines by a Russian missile over the Ukraine just happening just earlier today. I think Ukraine offers a lot of important lessons for the United States on how countries get themselves to the point that they want to be divided or could be divided. So, you know, I just look at some of the things that have happened in the Ukraine. So Russia is trying to expand its territory to include more ethnic Russians. So if do we have many ethnic Mexicans who live along our border with Mexico who might be interesting for Mexico to want to be able to reunite with over time? Well, certainly that's happening today, and that's one of the things that Russia has used to be able to build a case for taking Crimea and then eastern Ukraine and some of the other areas that they're continuing to try and build. You know, one of the arguments that in Ukraine that's driven the divide is that speakers of the minority Russian language consider themselves oppressed. Well, we already have schools in the Southwest that are teaching kids all day in Spanish, including at the community college level. So, and I think we're heading down a path where, in the interest of being multicultural and racially sensitive, we're going to suggest that kids should be able to learn in their native language. The problem with that is if we don't have a common language, we don't have an ability to solve problems, and we allow ourselves to be further segregated. And that certainly has played out in the Ukraine. There's a clear geographic concentration of Russian speakers. We'll see that here. There were several internal political leaders in Crimea, for example, in the Ukraine, who welcomed Russia's invasion. And we could get to the point where we have political leaders who see their interests as better aligned with creating, you know, a separate country out of the Southwest rather than being fully aligned with the United States. I don't think it's a stretch to think that we will have politicians who would put self-interest ahead of the nation's interest if they got to that point. The weakened indebted economy in the Ukraine is another issue, and the U.S. is certainly in a weakened an indebted state. We're not as bad off as the Ukraine is today, but we're not headed on a good path. And then, you know, you can get defections among the military. You have bases invaded quickly, as I outlined in Secession 2041. If you go take some of our Southwest bases, you can get there quickly if you can do it securely. Then you've got human shields to prevent the U.S. from responding. And those are some of the, just some of the ways that I think what we see in the Ukraine today we should be using as a lesson to help identify how do we not get ourselves to that point that we're setting the conditions where secession becomes more and more likely here.
An interesting aspect of this book, Secession 2041, is how it unveils the real motivations and links between groups and politicians that might not be apparent, including how closely the fictitious Castillo drug cartel is to important U.S. politicians. Is this a real danger that we face?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because as I've been studying immigration issues and border issues, we are finding an increasing number of Border Patrol agents, judges, politicians who are already on the cartel payrolls. Now, we're catching some of that, but we are going to see as the cartels get wealthier, as they consolidate and start to expand their political control, the ability for the cartel to have a heavy presence in our public officials' life is not a big stretch. I mean, all we have to do is go look back at how the mafia used their payments to judges and politicians and others to really insulate themselves from some of the justice that they might otherwise have been forced to endure. And to suggest that, and I believe we're going to face that same thing along the Southwest, we're already seeing evidence that it's happening. Yes, it's getting caught from time to time. But the other aspect that the cartel has really understands is that they can use terror to get people to do things that they wouldn't otherwise do. So we've seen billboards that have been defaced in a way that made it clear that the cartel was threatening U.S. politicians if they didn't make the right decisions. And we have to be very careful to not to understand just what a threat having those cartels at our southern border, in fact, actually sprawled throughout our American cities now, is to the future of the country.
Do you think these cartels are going to be just as dangerous as like Al-Qaeda and these other terrorist groups? Or?
Yeah, I do. And in fact, there's actually a big part of Secession 2041 is it identifies some of the links between the cartels and Al-Qaeda and other radical Islamist terrorist groups. If you understand the cartel business model, it's one of their suppliers is our opiates that are often controlled by radical Islamists in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and some other countries that aren't always particularly friendly to the United States. So a liaison or a link between the cartels and radical Islamists is a real threat to the United States. And in fact, our Border Patrol has caught on some occasions people that they believed were tied to Islamic terrorist groups coming in through the same cartel people trafficking measures as we have other people flowing in. So when our borders are porous and the cartels have great access to getting through our borders and know how to break through, they become a great agent to help Islamic terrorists. And that threat is one that I don't think we fully understand is coming our direction.
Do you feel like that we're going to have another 9/11 on a much bigger scale sometime down the road, or what's your feeling about that?
Well, that's my real fear. And, you look at a country like Iran getting closer and closer to having fully enriched uranium under their control. And every 6 month we give in shutting down their nuclear program, they get closer and closer to having what they need. All it takes is a little bit of enriched uranium and a little bit of know-how to fall into the hands of a terrorist group. And you can transport that. Now, if you stick a nuclear weapon on a truck and able to get it across the border through a tunnel and get it up on the U.S. side, there's nothing to say that weapon can't be unleashed on the U.S. And do a massive amount of damage. So, you know, when people say, you know, we need to have our open borders, I don't think they're really thinking through what the long-term consequences of that kind of approach is in terms of not everybody around the world likes the United States. There's a lot of people who think we are the great Satan. They call us the great Satan, and they want to wipe us off the map. And, you know, there's no greater glory in some of the most radical of Islamist groups than to be the guy who brings a nuclear weapon and detonates it in the middle of a U.S. city. I think we need to be very careful not to allow the conditions that make that easy to happen.
I agree with you. I think it's a very dangerous situation. You said in your press release on Secession 2041 that too many people are confusing welcoming diversity with supporting segregation. Can you have a diverse society without being a segregated society?
Yeah, that's probably one of the most important questions that America has to face and that we have to deal with is, I believe that it's important to have diversity. I worked for a global company. I worked with people all around the world. You know, there were 35 languages being spoken in the halls of the corporate headquarters I worked at in Naperville on a daily basis. So, I've learned that there are great people everywhere in the world. But the one thing that enabled us to function is that we shared one common language and happened to be English. Now, you could say that the United States should be an all-Spanish-speaking nation, but the reality is the majority of us speak English. And we have immigrants who come in from all over the world, and they're more likely to pick up English than they are to pick up Spanish. English is more likely to have been taught in their schools than Spanish would have been. In fact, I had an email exchange today with a woman that I worked with as a mentor at the University of Illinois, who's from Africa. She's here as a legal immigrant, and she's working on English as a second language programs, and it's all geared to Spanish-speaking students. So none of the African nations, the Eastern European nations, the Asian nation students are getting any support at all in these English as a second language programs. And so she was just asking, how do we deal with that? So we do have to make sure that we don't let ourselves be divided. So there's a big effort to suggest we need to be a multicultural nation. Well, what multicultural really means is segregated. We have to be a diverse nation. We are a diverse nation. We have to welcome that diversity. But then we need to create the melting pot. And one of the reasons I called the first book Melting Point 2040 is I think by 2040 we'll be at the point where our melting pot has reached a real boiling point, where we're not really, you know, melding our cultures and our flavors and our heritage is together to create something that's greater as a whole, but we're actually just isolating ourselves from each other. So to me, that's a critical question. We are a diverse nation. We should be a diverse nation, but we can't allow that to support segregation.
I noticed that you have a character, Bob Lee, who faces painful consequences when secession efforts turn violent. I was just wondering if Bob Lee is somehow connected to Robert E. Lee, who played a role in the Civil War.
Yeah, you know, that was just one of my little bits of history that I tried to put into the book was, Robert E. Lee, obviously, as you noted, was an important character in the Civil War trying to pull the nation apart. In this case, Bob Lee, who actually I don't identify as related to Robert E. Lee in any way, but I use the name Bob Lee on purpose, is trying to hold the country together and pays a painful price for the work he does. And really I use that because I just want to make the point that today's enemies might be tomorrow's friends. And that's a lesson I learned in politics from the congressman I worked for 25 years ago and one that I think is important, that we need to realize that we shouldn't have permanent enemies and permanent friends. We should look for how we work together. So that was just, I thought, just a little aside for the history buffs to note. And, you know, I see that you noted that.
Well, we've already talked about this a little bit, but I want to talk about it some more. Another aspect of your book that seems closely connected to the current situation in the world is the role that nuclear weapons are playing in terrorist efforts inside U.S. borders. With Iran gaining more concessions to build a nuclear bomb, do we have a reason to be concerned, and do you think Iran's going to become a nuclear power?
Yeah, I really, from what I've watched over the last couple of years, I think the chances now that Iran won't be a nuclear power is pretty low. You know, Pakistan has nuclear weapons, India has nuclear weapons. Iran certainly sees themselves as the central nation in the Middle East. Well, once Iran has it, then, you know, which Iran being a Shia nation, the Saudis are going to become deeply concerned as a Sunni nation. And while Sunnis and Shias are both Muslims, they don't, you know, they're both parts of Islam. They don't necessarily trust each other. And there's a lot, and we, in fact, we've seen in Iraq a lot of Sunni-Shia violence. We're going to see, if Iran gets nuclear weapons, I think a rapid escalation in the expansion of nuclear control around the world. It's got Israel is deeply fearful of Iran having nuclear weapons. You know, when they found the tunnel between the Gaza and Israel this morning with, I think it was 13 Palestinians crossing through on the tunnel, it just gives you an idea of how easy it would be to take a nuclear weapon, walk it across the border, explode it, and take, you know, a few million Israelis out. You know, it's a real concern. So I think if for Iran not to become a nuclear nation, it would require the United States being a lot stronger in stopping it, reimposing the really severe economic sanctions we had in place until about 6 or 8 months ago. And really keeping Iran away from that path. The other only other alternative is Israel goes in and bombs the nuclear locations out, and then I think the whole Middle East is in an uproar that we're not, as a country, going to enjoy.
You introduce a 14-year-old girl as a character in Secession 2041 who finds herself on the post-secession U.S. border scouting with her family to prevent troops from pushing into Utah after initial success in taking the Southwest. It seems to me that you were trying to make sure we really get to know a kid who suffers when our divides are allowed to get out of hand. Was that your purpose with Clarissa?
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. You know, I've talked to people who've read my books, and there is, you know, my older sister and my mom have complained at various times as they've read them that there's a little too much violence, and, you know, kids are getting hurt in that. And that's exactly my point, though. If we don't pay attention to these issues before they turn violent, they're going to be people who suffer, and some of those are going to be children. And so Clarissa, you know, is, you know, to me, an interesting character because she, you know, she grew up in a family where, you know, her dad insisted on her having survival skills. Some of it was for her own self-preservation, but, you know, she thrived in, as we got to the point where war seemed is starting to break out, and, you know, she needed to help out. But I wanted to make the point with, in using her in this, rather than just all military personnel, is that when the fight comes inside our borders, there's going to be a lot of civilian casualties, and we haven't seen civilian casualties on U.S. soil really since the Civil War. In the Civil War, you know, 800,000 people died, or 2% of the United States. If you took 2% of the United States out today, you'd have over 6 million people being killed, just to put it into perspective. And that's a lot of people who are going to be hurt, and a lot of families and a lot of relatives who are going to be in a lot of pain if we don't pay attention to these issues.
Radical Islam and several Islamic nations play an important role in supporting secession efforts in the U.S. in this book. And we already talked about radicalism, but what do you still believe they're a threat to the United States? And if so, how do we protect against it?
Yeah, I think it's important to recognize that, yeah, and I want to make sure that I'm clear here, that there are, you know, hundreds of millions of peace-loving Muslims who pose absolutely no threat to the United States. And, you know, there have been arguments about within the political world about whether, you know, as much as 25% of Islam is radicalized or the smallest number proposed by many who support Islam is that only 7% are radicalized. Well, 7% of 1.5 billion people is still over 100 million people who believe that suicide bombings are okay, who think it's okay to stone a woman who's an adulteress. There's a real culture clash between that radical end of Islam and Western democracy. And, you know, so Sharia law, which we obviously don't practice in the United States, but there are those who believe that that's the only law that needs to be followed. There are efforts in parts of Western Europe where Muslims have become a much bigger part of England and the Netherlands and some of the Nordic countries. There's an effort to get Sharia law driven into those countries. Well, we don't, I think, as a nation, want to get to where men and women need to be separated in public, and women need to be forced to, you know, wear veils or hide their appearance, or where, you know, there's no punishment if a husband beats his wife or rapes his wife or takes on multiple wives. So there's a real difference between that radical end of Islam and Western democracy. And what we hear from our politicians that if you question radical Islam, you must be a racist or you must hate those people. That's not the issue. We have to understand what their desires are and understand what can and can't fit with what we think is the way we want to live in the United States, and make sure that we understand it and only welcome those people into our borders who are willing to tolerate us living the way that the United States thinks we ought to live.
At the end of the book, the president gives a speech asking for support for another constitutional amendment around the golden rule of doing unto others as you would have them do unto you. Is this the subject of your next story, and you think the government can really live by the golden rule?
Yeah, in fact, the next book that I'm working on right now, and in fact I'm in the middle of proofreading as we speak, is it's God's Law ? The Golden Rule Crusade. One of the pieces that I think is missing out of our government today is any sense of morality and decency. And in fact, it's not built into our laws. Our founding fathers actually just assumed that we would follow the Golden Rule concept. And for those who don't know it, the Golden Rule is that you do unto others as you would have done unto yourself. Now, that sounds simple, but, you know, there's some complexity to it. You have to actually think really actively about what that means. But, for example, one of the pieces that I think is missing in U.S. law today is that if we had a Golden Rule constitutional amendment, Congress wouldn't be able to pass laws that they exempt themselves from. You know, for a member of Congress, a senator, to be able to go onto the House or Senate floor and libel people with no consequence doesn't make any sense. For them to pass Obamacare and have exempted themselves from many of its provisions makes no sense. There are many laws that have been passed by Congress over the years that they exempt themselves from. Well, if you have to do unto others as you would do unto yourself, those laws would have to go out the window. But mm-hmm. I think it would also get us to start having debates about laws on, you know, is this really the way I would want to be treated if I were facing this circumstance? And yeah. I use an example. Go ahead. Oh, there's just as an example, there was a woman in Florida, a woman named Marissa Alexander, whose husband had beat her for years. She had a restraining order against him. He came to her house, you know, intending to beat her again, and she took a gun out and fired it into the air. Didn't make any effort to fire it at him, but she wanted him to know she wasn't going to just take it again. Well, under Florida law, firing a weapon in anger, she received a mandatory minimum sentence of 20 years in prison for that. I think if you use the golden rule concept of, would we want to be treated that way? Do we think it makes sense that somebody who was just trying not to be beaten goes to prison for 20 years for that? I think we'd all say that that doesn't make sense. So I think adding that element to our Constitution helps us to be able to throw out laws that are written in a way that have, in many cases, very unintended consequences.
There's a few more questions I want to try to get to before we run out of time here. What do you hope to accomplish with your books and your writing?
You know, I really want to get people to think about the policies of today in terms of what our future is going to look like if we follow those. Because, you know, as you know, when you look at history and you think about how that translates into the future, you get a very different perspective of really what you want to do today. You know, just as we do as parents with our kids, you know, when a kid comes up and asks you, you know, can I buy this? Can I buy this? Well, if you answer yes and it's a one-time deal and you'll never be asked again, then, you know, most of us are going to say, oh, yeah, go ahead. But what we know is that if we get asked, can we buy this, and we say yes, we're going to get asked tomorrow, can they buy something else? And, you know, so we understand as parents those consequences, but we don't think about that when we're thinking about our politics. And actually, immigration is a perfect example. You know, the idea of having, you know, being humane and grateful and you know, Christ-like in some cases is the word some throw around, and just good neighbors to those who come across the borders illegally. The problem with that is you're not just doing it to those people. You're also sending the message to everybody else. Well, you come too. And if you look at what that does over time, it overwhelms nations. When a nation gets more people in than it can economically handle, it disintegrates. And I think there are some great attributes about the United States, about our Constitution, about the idea that our rights come from a creator who's greater than us, that are worth preserving. And I don't want to just throw them away when you really think about the long-term consequences of decisions we might be making today.
Well, what makes you an expert on the topics that you're writing about?
You know, it's I wouldn't say that I'm a great expert in the terms of there are people who have done little research on lots of different pieces and elements of what I write about. But what I think I'm very good at and what I've always prided myself on is the ability to put very disparate elements of data together in a way that creates a picture that's different than what other people see. One of the best compliments I got from one of the corporate executives I worked for when we were acquired for the fourth time in a 12-year span, the new owners came in and he said, well, the thing you'll learn about Mike is that he will often be in the minority in terms of what he says is the right answer, but he will always be right about what he's arguing for. You know, I don't argue about everything, but when you look at history, when you look at the data, when you study it in detail, you get really good clues as to what the future is going to look like. And that's something that I pride myself on, but I certainly use the work of literally hundreds or even thousands of people who have influenced my thinking and provided evidence that I've used over the years to help me build kind of the stories that I put together.
You write about some controversial topics using characters who have very different views of the world. Are you afraid that this might turn people off?
You know, I do on occasion have readers who say, oh, man, I couldn't stand this guy, or, boy, she was really miserable. And, every time her name came on the page, I just wanted to turn it. But I think it's important that we expose ourselves to people who have different perspectives or different views. And I try not to do it in a way, you know, and certainly there are characters that I don't like. I mean, I try not to present them as one-dimensional so that, you know, everything about them is bad, because that's just too easy. Because most people, there are elements of what they do and how they behave that you admire, and there are things you just don't like about them. And I think I try to do a good job of that with the characters. But yeah, there are people in these books who have a very different view of how the world should operate than I would argue is the right answer. But I understand where they come from and how they might have come to those the conclusions that they've come to.
Well, as a relatively new author, what have you learned that surprised you?
Well, I guess what I've learned is that there's a lot more to the marketing element of writing than and the publishing side of it takes as much time as the writing. I really enjoy the writing. I really enjoy the research, thinking about the stories. My research gets pretty in detailed, in fact, to the point where just a couple of weeks ago I had the FBI searching through trying to figure out who I was. And I guess if you do enough searching around radical Islam and Claymore mines and, you know, a lot of dangerous pieces of technology, eventually you're going to get on somebody's radar screen. And I'm glad they actually searched electronically rather than just busting down the door and throwing me against a wall. But I do love the research. I love the writing. I could do without some of the marketing headaches, but, you know, the pieces I really enjoy are being able to talk to people about what I've learned and also kind of hearing from others and hearing their questions so that I grow and I learn. I enjoy that exchange.
Well, how did you choose the topic for your first book?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, certainly I think the biggest thing that we have to do as a country is to get to is to fix our political system. But the biggest risk of the nation dividing and turning violent, a violent divide, comes from our resegregation of our country and how politicians are using that resegregation to pull Americans away from each other, whether it's on language or race or class or ethnicity. I mean, we just have to be aware that those are real dangerous divides that history has proven in many other countries typically turn deadly, and I really don't want to get to that point.
Well, it's been great having you on the show, Mike. We've got just a couple of minutes left. Is there anything else you'd like to tell the audience about your books that we haven't already discussed? Or?
Yeah, you know, I would certainly welcome input from your listeners or anybody else. There are a couple of ways that maybe if I could, I could let them know to get in touch with me. I have a blog at www.mbushman.com. I'm on Facebook at author Mike Bushman, and it's B-U-S-H-M-A-N. And you can email me at mike@mbushman.com. And then lastly, I'm on Twitter at m_Bushman, m_B-U-S-H-M-A-N. The books really are meant to tell a story of what the future could be. I will tell you it is not the future I want it to be. But it's the future I fear we're headed toward if we don't change to a better political path than the one we're on today.
Mm-hmm. Well, one quick question I want to ask you before we go off the air. What do you think about Obama's strategy over in Iraq right now with the problems we're having? Do you agree with what he's doing? Or?
No, I did not agree with the idea of going back into Iraq with under Bush Cheney. The reality is the big mistake we made in Iraq was during the Persian Gulf War when Hussein went into Kuwait. We needed to go take Hussein out then. Going back in later to get him out didn't make sense. Now, once we were in Iraq and we had started to secure improvements and peace, and you know, my brother-in-law served in Iraq, and I can tell you he didn't. It wasn't an experience he went in and enjoyed. But once we got there, to then pull our troops out and let the country deteriorate again into these segregated societies that are at war with each other, we're going to pay for that at some point. I just don't know when that's going to be. But those we've got a whole group of people who are learning how to fight and be militant and to kill that also don't like the United States.
Right. Well, it's been an honor to have you on the show tonight. I hope my audience enjoyed it. I really did. I recommend the books very highly. I think they're great. And I wish you well in the future, and thank you so much for being on the show.
Well, thank you, Jack. I really appreciate it, and it was a real pleasure to be with you.
Well, that's it for tonight. We'll be back next week with another interesting show. This is Jack Duffy signing off for The Man from 2063. Have a good night, and God bless America.
You have been listening to The Man from 2063, where the past meets the future with Jack Duffy.